Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome back, everyone, to not only a Friday edition of the Damage Report, but our last Friday edition before the midterms. Before next Tuesday, a day that could hopefully drastically change the direction that our country has been on for the past few years and give us at least some hope that what starts on Tuesday ends on, 2020 Tuesday or whatever. So obviously, big week coming up, hugely important. Today's show is going to be hopefully, we've got serious stuff and we've got two awesome guests that I'll preview in just a second, but we're also gonna have a little bit of fun. Did you know that the political climate is not only destroying our country and the environment, but your waistline too? We're gonna explain how that has played out. And I'm gonna preview this for you. Sometimes we have amazing facts of the day. I have the most LA liberal quote that I've ever seen in my life. And we're gonna have that at the end of this show. So watch until the finale. Brett Ehrlich is in studio, by the way.
Oh, I like him.
He's okay. He's pretty good.
He can be a little much sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. We have to do selective editing.
Too far, but relies too much on the edit to seem capable.
Seem capable.
Sadly, there are no edits on a live show.
No, there's not. No. So you're the host of the Happy Half Hour, which has an episode coming out today.
Yes, Matt Nelson from We Rate Dogs today on the program. John's dog Hilo gets rated.
He rated my dog.
As well as
other TYT dogs.
Everyone, please go out and watch. We Rate and go subscribe to.
They already
follow
do.
We Rate Dogs. You probably do because they have 7 million on of their handles. The other one is Dog Thoughts.
Dog Thoughts. Yeah. If you haven't already seen it, he rates dogs and gives little captions about them, and it is a very particular comedic sort of format.
Fantastic.
That he is. It's masterful, his execution of it.
Makes you want to kiss your fingers.
It does, it does. You have to. Later on the show, we're going to be joined by two guests. The first is Ali Cohn from the DSA's National Political Committee. And Ali is going to give us a sort of breakdown of some of the important DSA-backed or Democratic Socialist identifying candidates across the country. And also, we're going to do a little bit of an overview. This midterm cycle, how have these candidates and the DSA helped to reshape the conversation around some of the most important issues facing us as a country. Later on, we're gonna be joined by Gabriel Nadler, who is an animal activist and rapper about animal activism, who is going to talk to us about some elements of the what he calls the Republican war on animals, the various ways that regulations have been crafted and laws have been shaped to help to victimize animals in a variety of different ways, both here in the US and internationally as well. So that should be interesting. Probably not fun. It involves animal cruelty, but it will be interesting. But before we get into the important news, I want to start off with something a little bit fun. This morning, Donald Trump tweeted something, and we try to avoid just, covering Trump tweets, but this one struck home for me. So if we could put up this picture, you're going to see he tweeted that picture. Sanctions are coming November 5th. So first of all, let's just note, I'm sure that his massive change in American foreign policy being timed to the day before the election, that's just a coincidence. But obviously there, what he is mimicking with the font and with everything is Game of Thrones. And I have to say, while I don't like giving him credit for anything, that's good.
It looks good.
It's timed well. I don't mean it looks good.
I think it looks good.
Yes, it makes him look presidential or whatever, which it does take a lot of Photoshop to do that. No, but it's what he's doing with the whole Game of Thrones thing, where it's like, yeah, I hate you, but he knows how to needle you in just the right way, because he knows when he posts it how ridiculous it is that, like, if he was in Game of Thrones, he would at best be one of the villains, at best. And obviously, George R. R. Martin doesn't support Donald Trump. The vast majority of the actors obviously don't support any of his policies. I think he's aware of all of that. But he puts out that tweet just, again, like they say, to piss off people like me that actually like Game of Thrones and oppose him.
Don't ruin this for me. Do you think he's he is what would happen if Cersei could handle the faith militant?
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's what's happening. He's like, I'm pulling it off. My little, whatever it is, my high sparrow.
Yeah, he's the man, but the High Sparrow, he actually was a believer. I don't know.
Well,
yes, I do agree.
He's not the High Sparrow, but he's like what Cersei wanted by allying herself with the High Sparrow.
Mm-hmm.
The High Sparrow?
It's the High Sparrow, yeah.
Yeah, with by
it's been a while.
You know, the guy from Jumpin' Jack Flash.
I can't attest to that, but
Jagua.
Okay.
Anyways, by allying herself with that guy, what she sought to succeed in doing, that's what Trump is succeeding in doing. So it's actually maybe he watched Game of Thrones and he's like, I just need to keep a good eye on this.
Maybe. As I saw someone tweeted back to that. Yes, Donald Trump is like a character from Game of Thrones, except they never pay their debts. So he's actually the inverse of the Lannisters, maybe.
Lannister always welches. Same blonde hair, though.
Yeah, and I won't go through the whole thing.
This is absolutely killing you for that reason. Because no, you know you're so familiar with the source material that you know every way in which it is not congruent.
Yeah, and no, but the thing is, like, again, I won't go through the whole thing because if you watch the show, you know where I stand on this. Like, George R. R. Martin, the artist who created this world, most of the actors who have populated this world are not on your side, Donald Trump and right-wingers. But again, it's just they go through their lives referencing the artistic creations of people that they demonize. So they want to demonize the arts, but they still want to be affiliated with the cool stuff. Like Ted Cruz wants to talk about The Simpsons when The Simpsons writers actually hate Ted Cruz. He wants to reference things like that when they try to defund the arts. And George R. R. Martin obviously is not a right winger. And so that's the road that they have to walk, is they want to be cool. They want to be cool. They love the celebrity in Hollywood and everything like that. At the same time that they demonize it, when they attack creative people that are much more likely to be libs.
Right, but the sad intensity of Game of Thrones that you experience when you watch the bad guys win through playing terrible cards right. Mm-hmm. That's the feeling that I had on election day.
So you know, you're saying this is a meta thing.
Right. It's not meta. It's not meta at all. It's him. He doesn't understand that winter is coming is an inherently pessimistic concept.
It's true.
And not a one moment of victory touting oncoming success.
I didn't even, like, I guess I realized that, but I didn't consciously think about yet. He doesn't even get the format that he's aping. I was just talking about the show. You're right. In the context of the show, they're talking about this is a disastrous thing that we're going to have to go through. But he's like,
oh. Yeah, he's essentially saying, like, once the Night King gets here, it's all gravy.
Jesus Christ. And let's just acknowledge that his rallies are crowds of White Walkers.
So that's just part one of our analysis.
Okay, so after the break, we're gonna come back and talk more about Game of Thrones. No, we're not actually gonna do that. It was just frustrating. And I know that we did a study a couple of weeks back about his Twitter activity and what percentage of Americans actually pay attention to it. And the thing is, like, the people who respond the most to it, I don't just mean most intently intensely, because I know the right loves to say that we're triggered or whatever, but like just in terms of actually commenting at all or whatever, it's not Republicans. Like, there's a very small percentage of even Republican voters that even see his tweets, let alone interact with them. But this one, I guess I have to give him some credit. If the highest aspiration of the presidency is to be a troll, this is an example of it that I think actually works.
Yep.
Good job, idiot.
Most people want to build a bridge to the 20th century like Clinton did, but this guy just wants to live under that bridge and eat brains or whatever trolls do.
Exactly. Okay, we're going to go to our break a little bit early, but when we come back, we're going to be doing an overview of...
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The midterms from the point of view of some of the candidates that have identified as Democratic Socialists or have even been endorsed or supported by the DSA, and what approach they've taken to some of the big issues, helping to craft, I would say, the messages that have resonated the most in these midterms. We'll be back with that representative after this. So I think it's safe to say that throughout these primaries, this midterm cycle, some of the candidates that are exciting the most people and helping to drive most of the enthusiasm for the Democratic Party in these midterms are candidates that have embraced democratic socialism as a driving philosophy for their politics. And joining us now to help talk about the influence of that, we've got Ali Cohn of the DSA's National Political Committee. Ali, welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, very glad to have you here because I'm very excited about what you and your organization represent in these midterms. So I want to talk about the sorts of candidates that you guys have been backing or that you're enthusiastic about in these midterms. Who are some of the standouts?
Well, first of all, I want to say that what's most exciting to me is that we have candidates from all over the country, Montana to Hawaii, traditionally red states like Tennessee, New York, Houston, all over. So that's really exciting. Some of the candidates that are in some of the more exciting races, I guess the closer races, we have Kristen Seal in Pennsylvania. We have Franklin Bynum, who's running in Houston for the criminal court judge position. We have Jovanka Beckles in California. So some really exciting candidates.
And as you point out, these are not just congressional races necessarily. These are, you know, up and down the entire slate. I'm glad that there's been more focus, it feels like, in these midterms, not just for the DSA, but for others as well, that we can't ignore these state legislative races, you know, races for district attorney and things like that. These are very important for helping craft the direction of the country as well. So kudos to you for caring about those things. But I also want to talk about, I have noticed that there has been a lot of talk about democratic socialism as a concept during this election in a way that I haven't heard about in previous ones. You might recall Sean Hannity's explainer on what democratic socialism is when he listed a whole bunch of scary concepts that all seemed awesome. What have you thought about the way the media has approached the concept of democratic socialism so far?
I just think they're trying to do the same red scare that we saw back in the day, and they're really trying to appeal to the base of voters that they think have consistently voted, and excluding the millennials and the younger voters, because, you know, what we hear in the media is, oh, millennials aren't voting, and that's just not true. That's not what we're seeing in this election. And so what we're also seeing is democratic socialism is not a scary word to people under the age of 50. And to many people who are also over the age of 50, I don't want to be ageist about it, but it does seem like generationally that it is much more acceptable now amongst people under the age of 50 than we've ever seen before historically.
Well, I definitely have seen, I think it was in the 18 to 28 category, I saw that the favorability of socialism was actually higher than capitalism at this point, which certainly helps to buttress what you're saying. So would you say overall the sort of counterattack, I guess, in terms of the media, especially from the right on democratic socialism, although we've seen comments from people like Nancy Pelosi as well, largely isn't working?
Not in my areas of hanging out with people. And from what I've seen in talking to people nationally, democratic socialism is not a scary word. It's not a scary term. It's very appealing to people, like you said, because what you see is, you know, democratic socialists believe that the economy and the society should be run democratically. And that, you know, our younger people today are really hurting. I have three of my own children. As they come up and they see this inequality, they really see that there's got to be an alternative to the status quo. And we are that alternative. We're not a political party, but we're an organization who really appeals to the young people who see that inequality every day of their life, trying to go to college, student loans. So we fight for things like Medicare for All, College for All. We support those platforms that are going to make a better life for our working class individuals in the United States of America.
So just in case, I think most of our viewers here on the Damage Reporter are pretty aware at this point of how democratic socialism works, what it stands for and all that. But what lingering misconceptions have you seen bandied about the concept that you'd want cleared up?
I think that really what I would want to say is that, democratic socialists want to achieve a more just society. We have many structures of our government and economy that really need to be radically transformed through a greater economic and social democracy so that ordinary Americans can participate in the many decisions that affect our lives. I think this whole idea of we have to scare people because the Democrats and the Republicans have had this two-party system for so long and their way of thinking. And so the only way to keep basically continuing to oppress us in a capitalist society is to tell us that these alternative ways aren't going to work. And so they continue to just divide. And what we really need to do is stand together in solidarity and say, we're not going to take it anymore. And that's what you're seeing.
This might seem like a bit of an oddball question, but I'm just curious. So in this cycle, you've had a number of politicians who affiliate, they're either a part of the DSA or they call themselves democratic socialists that have been running as Democrats. Can you conceive of a time or an opportunity where a Republican candidate would actually agree with any of the major precepts of democratic socialism?
Absolutely. So I live in Tennessee. I live in a red state. We actually have a locally endorsed candidate, Edward Nelson, who is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, who is endorsed by our local chapter. And when he goes door knockings in a very red part of our country, Tennessee and most of the South continues to be very red. When you talk about the issues, Medicare for All, and you talk about a living wage, that resonates with people. What we're also seeing is, particularly in his campaign and many campaigns in the South, are these, white nationalists who come out who want to create, this alternative message based on who's running for office. And so when you see that, we don't want to put up with that. We don't want that. So I think that, yes, you're seeing these issues resonate with people no matter what their political alliance has been in the past, because the issues that we're facing today are incredibly important. We are in a dire situation and people see that.
So on those issues, one last question for you. If some of these, especially congressional candidates who call themselves democratic socialists, get into Congress or even to state houses as well, and maybe are able to form some sort of caucus or something like that and start to have an influence on the sorts of legislation that their party is pushing for, what are some areas that you would like to see them begin to address once they actually get into elected office?
Even before that, when you look at someone like Jovanka Beckles in California, who's running and supporting Proposition 10, so you see these ballot initiatives, for housing rights. You're seeing Proposition 4 in Florida for people who have been convicted of felonies to regain their voting rights. So just these basic human rights. That's what I expect to see. We've come so far off kilter with what we're looking at right now, with the presidency and the Senate and the House, that I don't think that the things that people would be asking for as democratic socialists are so way off base from what most people would agree with.
And I agree with that. Well, Ali Cohn, thank you for joining us on the Damage Report.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Donald Trump is apparently attempting to justify violence against migrants attempting to enter the US. We'll break down how that worked after this. Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. So much more to get to, and we've got Brett Ehrlich along for the ride.
Yeah, bummer.
Yeah, he's still here.
Let me know when he's done being on the show.
We're going to have fun a little bit later on. But before that, we're going to have the opposite of fun. Donald Trump is not a fan, obviously, of migrants, undocumented immigrants, legal immigrants, unless he's sleeping with them. He's not a fan of them, but he's moving way beyond his normal position and justifying violence against migrants attempting to enter our country in a hypothetical that you'll see in this video.
It's the military. I hope there won't be that. But I will tell you this, anybody throwing stones, rocks, like they did to Mexico and the Mexican military, Mexican police, where they badly hurt police and soldiers of Mexico, we will consider that a firearm. Because there's not much difference when you get hit in the face with a rock, which, as you know, it was very violent a few days ago, very, very violent. That break-in, it was a break-in in a country. They broke into Mexico. And you look at what's happening in Guatemala, just to mention Guatemala, along with El Salvador and Honduras. It's disgraceful that those countries aren't able to stop this, because they should be able to stop it before it starts. And the United States pays them a fortune. And we're looking at not doing that anymore, because why should we be doing that when they do nothing for us? Yeah.
The last 5 seconds of that video, his argument for why we're gonna not pay them, that is literally his argument for every single thing that he says. Whatever. Okay, so he talks there about if they throw rocks, we're gonna gun them down. We're gonna massacre this group of moms and kids and elderly people if they throw rocks. What you look like you wanna say something.
I wanna say that there is a difference between getting hit with a rock and getting shot with a bullet.
The president just said it's the same thing. Oh. Okay, you think you're smarter than the president. What is the difference?
Well, I am smarter than someone who is not smarter than a third grader.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that kind of statement is so insane to me.
It is stupid as a human can be.
Because it doesn't say in this, like by his logic in the Second Amendment, it should say, the right to bear firearms or rocks shall not be impinged.
Or in practice, if we were to say, you can't have any guns, but here's some rocks, now a Trump supporter would have to say, I guess that's basically the same.
Right.
Who needs an AR-15 when you can have a shiny skipping stone? It's the same thing. The president is saying that. And by the way, I know I'm joking there, but seriously, like he is saying this just days out from a horrendous act of gun violence, the worst attack against Jewish Americans in the history of our country. And he is effectively saying that if that guy had entered the Tree of Life synagogue with a bucket of rocks, I guess it would have been as bad. It wouldn't matter, okay? It would be the same thing, whether he has an AR-15 or a bucket of rocks, the same thing. That is ridiculous. That is absurd. And he knows we're in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of that shooting.
And just this is a ridiculous hypothetical that is so far from even having the potential to materialize. And it is, the first ridiculous thing that he did, it's like an improv thing. You're like, you find the first unusual thing and then you make it a heightened unusual thing and you keep getting more and more ridiculous. So the first unusual thing he did was, I think the first thing was, let's send 5,000 troops to the border, and it's gotten bigger, that number, since then. But we'll send the 5,000 troops to the US-Mexico border at a time when this caravan of marauding people, in his mind, which it's not, it's parents with strollers and kids, is getting to the Mexico-Honduras border.
The extreme south of Mexico.
Which is 2,500 miles away. Either way, it's thousands of miles away. So that is a ridiculous, unusual thing. The second thing is to say, I'm gonna end birthright citizenship. These are both parts of the argument both part of the rhetorical mission to make this about immigration, which he, in his mind, believes he won on from the beginning. You guys wouldn't be talking about immigration if it wasn't for Trump. Trump's the one who brought up immigration. Those are the first two unusual things. And this one is taking the aftermath of the first and second unusual things and making a ridiculous hypothetical that won't materialize for 2 months after the election is done. And the only reason he's doing it is to frame his narrative of immigration going into the election on Tuesday.
Yeah. So this is like an ongoing episode of whose campaign narrative is it anyway?
It's just, it's going off into crazy town.
Yeah.
It is a so much further off the rails. What if these people who aren't close throw rocks? He wasn't asked, what if they throw rocks? He was like, are we gonna open fire on them? He's like, no, I hope it doesn't come to that. But if they have stones?
Yes, he is saying that our military cannot withstand, like outnumbering them with the best trained and equipped military in the world, they cannot withstand stones. If they do not begin firing, they will be overrun. That is what he is attempting to say. Thank you for pointing out the distance. It's like saying, well, there's people in Reno. Deploy the troops to Pittsburgh. We got to head them off. That is effectively what we're talking about. You can check the distance. I don't know for sure, but that sounds about right, actually. By the way, not that it matters again, because nothing matters, but his description of what happened to the Mexican military was not accurate at all. Leila Santiago tweeted, Trump on caravan, they've overrun and hurt badly Mexican soldiers. Just got off the phone with Mexico. They tell me two federal police officers were struck by rocks during a confrontation at border. Injuries were, quote, not serious or life-threatening. Because they're just rocks. So it's not at all the thing that he is implying it to be. I want to talk a little bit more generally, but first, why do we care about this? Why does it matter that the president is saying a rock is the same as a gun? If someone throws a rock at you, you can shoot them. It's the same as them shooting at you. First of all, because again, his crazy supporters are listening to this and they now believe, what if Antifa throws a rock at you? You can gun them down. It's the same thing as them firing a gun at you. So expect more gun violence here in the US, but internationally, we don't need hypotheticals because we've already seen how foreign governments have picked this up. The Nigerian government, which fired on protesters recently, released this statement. This is a spokesman for the Nigerian army. This is according to the New York Times. John Agim said, they put out this video about Trump's quotes and said, we released that video to say, if President Trump can say that rocks are as good as a rifle, who is Amnesty International, who has been against their oppressing of those protesters? What are they then saying? What did David use to kill Goliath? So a stone is a weapon. They're saying that if the President of the United States says it's okay to fire on people with rocks, well, we're certainly going to do that too. And if people, protesters, get out of hand, President of the US is saying you can gun them down. That was that wasn't like 6 months later. That was the day after he put out that video. Mm-hmm. Already foreign governments are saying we can use this to justify brutal, violent crackdowns on dissidents in our country.
Yes, and his logic is, I mean, he's made this argument that the other countries are killing us. Why should we do all this stuff? And a lot of it was Obama was leading from behind. Mm-hmm. And I want to lead from the front. But what you do when you make these kinds of decisions and present yourself in this way is you are leading the wrong people in the wrong way. And we have to be that inspiration. And as much as we've tried in the past to be that inspiration to other people and stand for freedom, yes, we've done terrible, terrible things. But now we're not even pretending to be the good guys.
We're not.
And that's terrible.
Because also, the supporters don't want us to be the good guys.
I said the border of Mexico and Honduras when I meant Guatemala.
That's possible. By the way, did you catch in that video of him really trying hard to pronounce those names correctly? I want to give him credit for that. Not to mention Honduras.
Honduras.
He was really pronouncing the hell out of those. One other thing I want to say. So I've said a couple of times over the past year or so that while I am obviously I oppose Donald Trump and he's done a lot of horrible things. One thing that he had not done was really overplay a terror attack or, you know, like send tons of troops into Syria or something like that. Like he had been a little bit restrained in trying to use American foreign policy to rile up the domestic base, something that George W. Bush did many times. I was worried that Trump would draw from that same Dick Cheney playbook. And I guess it's taken me a couple of days to realize, but that is exactly what we are in right now. This is a wag the dog situation playing out in real time. But the funny thing is, they don't need a terrorist. They don't need a foreign country to go to war with. They can send thousands of troops against a non-existent foe. They can then say, we're gonna have to gun them down against non-existent weapons. All of this doesn't even require opposition. He can just pretend we're at war with something in the literal last days of an election, and we accept it as, oh, the president is just trying to protect America. This is the most blatant misuse of the military in advance of an election in my lifetime. We have got to oppose this and recognize what it is.
And it's not, this is a yearly caravan too.
Like it happens all the time.
It happens every year. And every year, 300 people get here. Mm-hmm. And every year, we have a process for processing them. And every year, they're not invaders. Every year, they're refugees escaping some horrific violence at the hands of people in the country that they're fleeing.
Yeah.
As a result of situations that, let's face it, America's activities in Central America over the last 50 years have exacerbated, if not created.
Yeah.
So, and again, it's you're seeing pictures of these kids being helped off boats into hopefully a better future.
Yeah.
And that same dynamic has been at play since the founding of the country, where Donald Trump's mom did that. That's what's so frustrating. And it's I don't know. And the problem is, like, I had a conversation with someone who is a financial advisor who is a fighter pilot, and all of this rhetoric seems to be working on him. And despite the fact that he does not like the president. Mm-hmm. And he, in the military, said,
I still believe some of these arguments.
Yeah, he does. I don't want to work for the president. None of them would want to work for the president now. But still, like, this fear of invasion by immigrant works.
Yes, but I will close the segment by just saying one good thing. In terms of polling, when asked, is immigration a net good for our country? The people saying yes are actually at record highs. So perhaps there is a bit of a backlash going on to Trump and his rhetoric. Okay, with that said, we are going to take a break. When we come back, Gabriel Nadler is going to be joining us to break down the Republican war on animals. What does that actually look like? Talk about after this. Republican control of government hasn't just been bad for humans, it's actually been pretty horrendous for animals as well. And joining the show now to break down this war on animals, animal activist and rapper Guy Azai. Welcome to the show.
How's it going, John?
It's good to have you here. So I read your piece on Medium talking about a huge list of different policies and changes in regulations that negatively impact various animals. So first, an overview, this war on animals, what is it like?
So in a few broad categories, I mean, the most obvious and easy for people to understand is blatantly shooting animals. The one that probably made the most news was changing the laws to allow for the shooting of hibernating baby bears, mother and wolf puppies in so-called wildlife refuges, as well as brutal trapping and the gassing of their dens, and a whole slew of pro-hunting policies, including the hunting of endangered species. With Ryan Zinke in charge of Interior Department, he's a trophy hunter himself. And as you know, the NRA is a prime backer of the Republican Party. Sport Hunters Associations are a pillar of the Republican Party. So he's just been advancing their interests across the board. That's the most obvious way. But sadly, it's the least impactful way on animals. The more broader ways would be poisoning the air that we breathe, the water we drink, which is not an animal issue uniquely. That's a human issue. I don't think your viewers need me to explain how bad Trump has been as far as pro-fossil fuels. It's just a reminder that all of those things are toxic to humans and animals in a similar way, cause cancer in humans and animals. And of course, all those same things accelerate climate change and mass extinction, which is by far the biggest issue, again, for humans and animals. The same reason that Miami, New York City, where I am right now, is going to be underwater is the same reason that mass extinction is accelerating. So those are the broadest categories, I would say.
I wanted to return just briefly to what you're talking about the hunting. So you were talking about the sport hunting associations that support him, these trophy hunters. So I guess I'm not a hunter, although my father was. It seemed like there was supposed to be a little bit of challenge to it. Gassing dens and shooting hibernating animals doesn't seem like much of a challenge. So are the people pushing for this, are they people who hunt like for sport as a hobby? What's the justification for these sorts of effectively just, I guess, executions of animals?
The justification in that particular case was that they're attacking predator species. They want to be able to shoot more herbivores. But they say that the bears and the wolves are eating the herbivores. They want to be able to shoot more herbivores, so they need to shoot the carnivores. It's totally non-scientific and nonsensical, which is not a surprise. For the Republican Party, it doesn't relate at all to what biologists and conservationists will say, but that's their excuse. And it's similar to the reason the NRA will oppose even the most tiniest reasonable gun control measures, is because it their profit is based on it. Yeah. Bullets are being sold, hunting licenses, you know. So they're just fundamentalist in this regard. Anything that involves limiting hunting rights, they are against.
Okay. So in your article, and you mentioned your previous comment about the push for more exploration for oil, but also sort of doubling down in a variety of ways on coal and the effect that that has on both animals and humans. What are some of the changes that they've made in those areas?
So the biggest and worst change. So a lot of people were disappointed with President Obama's time in office. I myself, because I'm paying attention to these issues, Obama made the biggest progress in human history on reducing toxic pollution, greenhouse gases, and in protecting wilderness and oceans. He saved 553 million acres of earth and ocean. And with the Clean Power Plan and with the increased fuel efficiency standards, he made the biggest cuts to greenhouse gas emissions and the biggest strides that the human race has ever made in dealing with the climate crisis that is threatening our very existence. So Trump, of course, reversed that. He killed the Clean Power Plan. He killed the new vehicle emission standards. Luckily, the national monuments are harder to reverse, so he shrunk the size of some of them, but it's 553 million acres. Most of it, thankfully, is still intact. Trump has shrunk the areas where they want to do uranium mining and I believe coal mining.
Yeah. So you did mention endangered species, and I've seen a few times over the past year some proposed changes to the Endangered Species Act. How worried should we be about these sorts of protections?
I would say extremely, because once again, even if someone doesn't care at all about animals, even if someone was a total sociopath who didn't care, they're doing these things to advance coal mining and fossil fuels, which are giving humans cancer. The Clean Power Plan was estimated to save around 2,500 Americans' lives a year. So almost a September 11th a year. And that's just from cancer and respiratory diseases. But if you think about, again, the consequences for our major cities flooding, for running out of water, for all the horrible consequences of climate change, it becomes much worse. So that's the bad side. I would say, this is all kind of depressing. There is a good side to this, to all the story, which is that I think these are issues that could really help Democrats win. If we pay more attention to this, every single election, there's this holy grail of the millennial voters. How do we get the young voters out? We need to get them out, but they never show up. Well, in my opinion, if you want to get the young voters to show up, you need to talk to them about what they care about. So look at Bernie Sanders. Like, he was successful in part because he made a very big deal about student loans, about the price of university education. A lot of young people care about that. A lot of young people showed up. It's too bad he wasn't the presidential candidate. An enormous amount of young people love animals so much that they don't eat animals. Veganism is exploding across the board in the US, but particularly in the millennial demographic. So these are people who, they're not eating bacon because they love animals so much. They're going to protests in the winter at fur stores. They will easily put an X on a piece of paper and vote if they knew how it mattered for animals. So that's why I'm trying to raise awareness on it. And to be fair, a lot of these people, the reason they don't vote is not that they don't know how bad Republicans are. They'll just say, Democrats are the same. They support mass animal abuse and slaughter through subsidizing animal agriculture. And first of all, I mean, that is true in some cases, but what I'm trying to illustrate is that there's a mass extinction of a difference that separates the two, and that if people who love animals get involved in politics, then we can push Democrats to be more progressive on these issues the same way that Bernie did. Now healthcare is a central tenet of the Democratic platform. So there's issues that everybody, almost everyone in the country, even Republicans agree with, like trophy hunting. Most Republicans are against trophy hunting. Mm. So we could ban that tomorrow if we made it into an issue, but it would be a winning issue because Republican politicians can't back it because the NRA and the sport hunting associations won't let them. Yeah. So if we turn that into an issue, Democrats can win on it, and Republicans need to stand up and say, yes, I support shooting hibernating bears, So in any case, sorry, I'm going on too long.
That's okay. And hopefully we will see more of that type of campaign in the future. But guys, I thank you for joining us and I'm gonna break down some of the stakes in terms of the war on animals.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you. We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, we also have to worry about our own bodies. Apparently politics is taking its toll. We'll describe that after this. So ever since the 2016 election, or even during the primary, it's been very common to joke that politics is destroying you. Mentally, but also physically, that you stressy and you drink. There's a lot of drinking jokes. Turns out they're not just jokes, though. There's actually some data behind it. There's a new survey, a poll conducted by YouGov, commissioned by the fitness site Daily Burn, which is not rap slam videos. It's about burning calories. 50% Democrats are 50% more likely than Republicans to say they're eating their feelings as a result of the current political climate. They're also drinking more, a 2-to-1 ratio over their GOP counterparts.
We sound so much cooler.
We do sound cooler, although it sounds a little bit just like a bacchanalian, like, but no, it's not. It's actually, it's a bit depression, it's a bit coping.
I would say in general, Democrats are more likely to use the term eat my feelings. Which is why I would respond to that. But yes, effectively, are they eating their feelings regardless of how they respond word for word, eating my feelings? Yeah, I totally get it. I feel really sad sometimes when I get done with a day here in this building of soul-wrenching news. That's why the Happy Half Hour, which you should watch today at 5 p.m. on the Young Turks YouTube TV channel and then subscribe, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I also have been drinking more. Invented a show to cope
to drink.
With it explicitly by drinking.
Yeah.
What do you think about this, John?
Well, I think I have noticed, I think The thing that I had to realize about my issues with food was that, like most people, if I have a bad day or stressful day, I feel better when I eat. But also, when I have a good day, it's like, ooh, celebrate, eat.
Yeah,
you can't do both.
You're setting up a terrible incentive.
Oh God.
Sophie making this.
Sophie, come on with the chicken.
It looks so good.
If you're on the podcast,
it's just the deepest dish pizza you've ever seen, shared by a bunch of perfect friends. Oh my God! And then there's a burger. Oh, and I get mad when you mention the B-roll on the show as it's playing, and here I am just being like, stress eating. There's like seven images.
Yeah,
too.
if you listen to the podcast, that's awesome. Hopefully, rate it 5 stars on iTunes. Please send me a screenshot of your review. But you do miss out on the B-roll, which is pretty awesome from time to time.
What you're doing when you're setting up like a, you know, this is my cheat day. I'm having a bad day. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna have food I like for a change. You are incentivizing the mindset of having a bad day, so that you will reward yourself with a cheat day, and then you end up accentuating the negative to bring about a positive, and that is really bad.
Do you want to hear? So I alluded to this earlier. Do you want to hear the most like Hollywood liberal or LA liberal quote,
please,
ever? So first of all, the setup: Democrats are not just eating more and drinking more; they're also working out more by as much as 40%. So that's the first thing. And I think we probably would have expected that too. But so to describe that, Dr. Navya Mysore says, I'm seeing some people so stressed at the moment, they're doing 2, even 3 soul cycle classes a day. Trump! 2 to 3 soul cycles.
When's that next hill?
By the way, I'm pretty sure 2 to 3 soul cycle classes a day would cost $300 a day. I don't know what crazy celeb thing. It's super, super bougie and expensive.
I used to live near a Yaz Fitness, which is the world's smallest garage that has the world's highest concentration of stationary bicycles. And I wanted to bring a stationary bicycle and put it outside the garage, which they had open because it was the hottest place ever, and just like bike next to them and just be like, oh wow, you guys are here too. I was just stationary biking by here.
Jesus. I would like to see someone with a trailer with a stationary bike on it riding down the road. You still want to get somewhere.
There are a couple inventions that are amazing. I lived in Venice for a very long time and they invented the elliptical bike, which is essentially an elliptical machine that is attached to wheels, and so
it moves.
You can elliptically.
God, that must look weird.
The motion is you just running. You're just running faster than everyone on your elliptical machine. The other thing, which I covered on Viral Video Film School 1,000 years ago, is an outdoor treadmill, which is a treadmill, and you hold it, but the treadmill device is hooked up to wheels.
So okay, I want to see that.
You're just running around outside, and that's what's happening.
Okay.
Do you think that if there are wins as a result of the midterm elections, that there will be a change in people's eating habits?
Well, I can't speak for most people, but I can say that we, regardless of win or loss, we are going to have the second installment of our tradition, which I would like to see spread, so feel free to do this.
Yeah.
Last year, on the anniversary of Donald Trump winning the presidency, we began our new tradition of the I Can't Believe He's Still in Power Hour, where you get together all of your friends and you do a power hour, where you take a shot of beer every minute for 60 minutes while commiserating over the state of the country and playing awesome music from the 90s and today. So we did that. We're gonna do it again this year, but now we actually have the opportunity. It could be commiseration or it could be celebration, but either way, we've got the keg.
Thank God he's got less power hour, hopefully.
Oh, we can rename it.
You know,
we should totally do that.
When it comes to the house, at least we have more power hour.
One way or the other, it'll work. We're gonna have to figure it out on Tuesday. But if you end up having one of those, let us know. You could tweet us, send in a picture, it'd be awesome.
Maybe I can make the video available online for people to download. Because it really is, like, I carry the power hour with me on my keys every day of my life. It's on a little USB key on my keychain.
To give you an idea of what he means is his wife put together an hour-long video of minute segments of awesome music videos from the 90s, interspersed by old viral video segments and weird things where she dresses up as Donald Trump and stuff like that. Anyway, maybe we can make that available, although it is the most copyright infringy thing that's ever existed. Anyway, we're out of time. It's been a fun week. Next week, I think it might be fun. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you.
Thank you to those watching. We'll see you next week. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.